step inside the tribe as our market experts share their boots on the ground experience from the front lines of freight tech's emergence. I'm Tim Dooner, and this is Freight Waves Insiders.
Hello and welcome back to Freight Waves Insiders. I'm Dooner, and joining me today, in person, Guillermo Garcia, CEO, co-founder, Smart Hop, Venezuelan, now living in Miami, Mr. Worldwide. How you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for hosting me. I mean, this is how we like to do it, in person.
I love, nature is healing. Like having someone in this seat. And I know I rechristened the studio with my dad for the first show, but we're still in that hybrid world where you got to do the Zoom meetings. And I'll tell you, I'm so zoomed out. Like when someone just sends me like a phone call link, I'm ecstatic.
I'm ready to go back. That definitely. I mean, when we decided to come here, I was like, no, I'm not doing Zoom anymore. I'm flying over there.
Yeah. No, it's great having you in person. You get so much more energy, and I think we're here for it. I mean, F3 is coming up. We're having our live event, F3, November 8th to 10th in Chattanooga. I wish it was next month, to be honest with you.
I think a lot of people are ready to come here and be in person and have that interaction. I mean, there's something about being in person that no Zoom can replace.
Can replicate. Well, real quick, just give us sort of an elevator pitch. We're going to get into like your life story, building Smart Hop and all that. But just to give some context to all this, what's the elevator pitch kind of on you and Smart Hop right now?
Yeah, so I originally come from Venezuela. I've been trucking in the trucking industry for a long time. Started out as a pet food delivery, but made my way into trucking. Came to the U.S., wanted to do better for myself and for the many other truckers out there, very small trucking companies, and built Smart Hub, which is a business-in-a-box model that empowers those very small trucking companies and owner-operators to have all the tools and the resources that they need to be successful.
I love it. And you guys, how many years has Smart Hop been around now?
So it's been a couple of years now, developing, I want to say over 2 years, but being fully live, we launched in February of 2020. So think about deciding a good month to launch just a month before COVID hit.
Now, this isn't like the first interview recording you've done this week. Just yesterday, I understand you were recording in a thunderstorm in Kentucky with Rate Per Mile Masters. If you guys know that board, Chad Boblett. What brought you there? What happened there?
Well, I mean, I've been friends with Chad a long time, and we wanted to bring this like true conversation, right? Yeah. Of the real issues of the day-to-day owner-operator or small trucking companies. And we were talking, we wanted to do live, and we started a nationwide tour that we're going to be going through different states, different cities, just talking about issues and from our own experiences, just giving some information and support to others. But tell about Storm. We decided that we wanted to do it outside. Nice. We're ready to be outside. We selected this great place. It was a rest area where trucks park. We were in this canopy. Well, it was kind of cloudy. Yeah. We saw the weather. We set up our phones and cameras. Just a minute and a half after Chad said, let's hit the live button. Man, it was like Katrina coming through us. I mean, and we were live. It was like an hour conversation. We got all wet. I mean, my feet were soaked. I had to buy a pair of socks at the Lexington airport. But we had a fun time.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. So, like on What the Truck the other day, big issue that came up was OIDA was urging truckers to fight back against this proposed insurance hike, raising insurance 556%. Earlier on, there had been talk about raising the insurance to $2 million about a year ago. OIDA hated that as well. Did that come up at all? Because I know a lot of truckers are super concerned about this, especially the ones that you deal with, because you deal with the real sort of truck. I don't want to say real. I mean, the major carriers are real. They own a lot of capacity, but 90% of trucking companies are these smaller companies, the ones that are most at risk to giant insurance hikes like this?
Well, and insurance is very personal to me, because when I got to the U.S., aside from not having a credit card, Social Security, so I was a nobody here. I had a good trucking company in Venezuela, but for the U.S., I was a nobody. The reason why I had to start under someone's authority was because of insurance, and was because I was based in the wrong zip code. And that was it. I mean, I was in South Florida. No insurance companies want to do anything with trucking companies that are in South Florida. And so that was a very personal. So yeah, yesterday we talked a bunch about insurance. And for me, it was, I mean, depending on insurance, or insurance can really affect if you have a profitable business or not. Prohibited rates. Today, you're paying 4, 5, 6 times what the large mega carriers are paying, just for the fact that you're very small. Yeah. You might be based in the wrong zip code, and you don't have any leverage to really make sure that the carriers underwrite you in a different way, right? I mean, why am I being underwritten because of the county that I'm based on? Why can they underwrite me based on how well I do, how well I run my business? And so if you add up cost to insurance, I don't know what's going to happen. But I mean, the very small trucking companies are going to suffer. And yes, I mean, we need to fight back.
Yeah. So what was wrong? What's wrong with, why don't they like insuring the area that you're in Florida?
I'm going to tell you the story. And this is how I personally run my health insurance. I try not to, I'm very careful about insurance, right? I try not to get to the insurance for any very small thing, just to protect myself, just to protect when renewal comes, for them not to have an argument to say your rates are going to spike. Same thing with my trucking company, right? We didn't do anything. We paid for those. I think it was 4 years in, I received an email from my insurance broker saying, hey, you're done. You're out of the insurance. I was like, we haven't put a single claim in 4 years, and you're telling me that you're not renewing my insurance? And the response that I had was, you're in Miami-Dade. Your company is based there. We don't want anything to do with Miami-Dade, Broward, or West Palm. If you relocate to Orlando or north to Orlando, we might be able to do something. I'm like, are you serious? Are you telling me I don't have a claim? I mean, I've been behaving, and you're telling me that I need to base my trucking company elsewhere for you to consider me safe? And that's the real world. I mean, that's what people face, and that's why people are putting like ghost companies somewhere else just because of insurance. And if you don't, if you consider insurance rates, and you're really on a bad state insurance rate wise, you might not have a business at all.
So your first piece of advice today would be to anyone out there thinking of starting a trucking company: check the insurance rates in the area before opening up shop, because you might be in for a surprise.
I mean, definitely. I didn't have that person when I landed in South Florida coming to U.S. telling me not to base an over-the-road trucking company in South Florida. One of the reasons that I would say is, yes, if you want to open your authority, if you want to become a trucker, you're a company driver and you're making your leap, or if you're really thinking about what the impact of this new laws or what's going to happen, if that happens, is think about insurance. Think about which are the states and the cities that you should be on, because it's not going to get pretty.
Yeah. Well, the big conversation that it's still going on was the big exodus from San Francisco to Miami and Austin as well. But Miami, the mayor, he was pushing hard to attract people. Is that exciting to you? You want more of that blood coming into the region?
Yeah. I mean, what's been happening with this hype, with the press, but also what happened with COVID, not only Miami. I think that we have been getting recognition from people in the industry, from venture capitalists, from others, to say you can also build a great, sustainable, and big company outside of the main metropolitan areas, outside of the main hubs of the tech ecosystem. And so that's one thing that's really good for Miami. It's helping us attract good talent. People are now more open on saying, yeah, if it's a Miami-based company, why not, right? I mean, and also people that are based on those cities that are looking for more space that went through COVID, stuck in a small apartment, not having oxygen.
We were there. I got two kids upstairs. I have a wife here. We have the dog who keeps coming on to come and hang out with us on the shot. But we just ran out of room. You know, we were going nuts. So we bought this house. Now we have the studio in here. It's been great. But COVID starts changed psychologically. It changed the psychology of a lot of people. Now you are how many people are you up to now?
We are about 60 now.
So has this helped accelerate the hiring, though, that with remote options, all of those kind of things, the focus on Miami, is that making that more attractive?
Yeah, 100%. And I want to say that the good thing about what's been going on is even those that we hire in New York, to have that option, to be a couple of months during the winter, have the option to go down to Miami or even to relocate and have the option to be in Miami, but to be elsewhere. I'm saying Miami because we have a physical office in Miami. We have a physical office in New York as well, but we have people remote. We are a distributed team. And so the good thing about what we have as a company and what we offer people that we bring is our offices are places for you to go to, but you don't have to go Monday through Friday. I mean, if you decide to go one day a week, 5 days a week, those are places where we get together, maybe some specific meetings or events, we all come together. And I'm a true believer that Zoom will never be able to replace that in-person interaction. So every once in a while, we go to Miami or to New York to physical offices. But at the end, the good thing about the hybrid model, the model that we have is, even if you live in Miami, you have the option to go to the office. You don't need to go to the office. And to tell the truth, those that come from the industry, this is like game changer because they're going from clocking in and clocking out. I had one person tell me when they went into our offices, this guy told me he's in dispatching ops. And this guy that I told me, the first impression was, man, you have windows. Wait, what? And he was like, yeah, I mean, we were like dispatchers in a room, no windows in like industrial areas. So we want to be able to have that great environment for our people.
Well, I mean, and that can't be understated. When I was on the operations side of freight, one of the biggest causes of burnout for me was just that sort of oppressive micromanagement that happens in a lot of brokerages because so many shipments are sensitive and they're time sensitive. And a lot of managers have just been trained to have a lot of oversight. And it can be like so stifling after a while. Let's go back in time, though. So you're from Venezuela, right? You had a life in Venezuela before you moved out here. So let's start there. 16 years old. What did you think you were going to be when you grew up? Were you looking at colleges out of Venezuela? What did you think would happen with your life?
Well, I mean, since I can remember, I mean, from like early, very young, I've been wanting to do stuff on my own, right? And I come from a very traditional family. I mean, my dad has been working in the same institution for over 40 years. So he believes in the institution. He believes that you have to go to college, graduate. You have to go into a public traded company that they will train you. And my independence in a way, working for summer camps and going on during the weekends and working for them, but also here and there selling stuff. And so Venezuela, when I was young, went through a very tough time where people were marching on the streets and they were against the government. And even to that extent, we sold water in those events. And I had a honey business with a longtime friend as well. I then made my leap when I was in college to have a pet food delivery company. So I started as a pet food delivery guy. And so I've been doing a lot of stuff against my dad's will.
Yeah.
He pressured me a lot when I went into college to work for someone big. And he made it happen. So between my honey business, being a pet food delivery guy, and college, I started at Nestle.
Yeah.
And I think
that... I've heard of them. They're pretty big.
Yeah. But, I mean, you can say that. I mean, I started in supply chain, and I think that's where my love for logistics came. So I had to give credit to my dad for pushing me to work with someone like Nestle. I started in supply chain, but man, I was in supply chain scheduling the chocolate factory for Nestle in Venezuela in suit and tie. I didn't see a client in my 3 years at Nestle, and I had to go to work in suit and tie every single day. I mean, after 3 years, I'm like, Dad, I'm done. Are you happy? Yes, I'm gone.
Yeah.
And then that's when my journey in trucking started.
Yeah, so tell me about Venezuela, because I think most Americans, they think cheap gas, they think like, you hear like a meme story, like Hugo Chavez buys a Twitter follower a house, right? But what is Venezuela like? What's it like growing up there? What are the opportunities like?
Well, I had a great life up to when I was about 17 or 18. It was a great country. I mean, it cannot have a better weather, cannot have a better geographical location. I mean, it's an incredible company, sadly, poorly managed. And so when you hear about the stories today, yes, Venezuela is bad. I want to say it's not as bad as the media puts it out there. Definitely, a lot of things are going wrong. Definitely, there is insecurity. I mean, they have the government has really avoided private companies to evolve there. And so now it's a country really run by the government. The private sector is very depressed. So now I turn into, I want to say that it's now 10 or 15 times smaller when it comes to consumption, when it comes to companies versus what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, so you're there. That's Venezuela. You work at Nestle, stifling. You're not talking to anybody. You're basically, you're not even doing Zoom calls, but you got to sit there in the suit and tie. You say, screw this. Is that when you go, I got to get to America?
Well, that's when I decided to, turn my pet food delivery.
You were still running
business. It wasn't a business. It was me, like, really. I mean, in the mornings and in the afternoons, it was me delivering in my hometown, Caracas. That's when I decided and say, I want to turn this gig, if you want to say it, into a real thing. And so I turned that business into a trucking company. And in my experience in Nestle, I got to know that big companies subcontract independent trucking companies. And so I bought my first Sprinter van and made my way through trucking, grew that a little bit, and then I received a call from Nestle.
Okay.
And they said, in a different city, they said, listen, I mean, we're up for a bid. We want to bid this cocoa warehouse that it's very simple. You'll store cocoa for us, and we'll ask you to ship that to our production plant. And I bid, I won that. And so I started then transforming that trucking business into a full logistics company that ended up having about 500 employees.
Oh, wow. And this just started as like, were you like originally like a bicycle or something delivering pet food locally?
It wasn't a bicycle, it was my car. It was my dad's garage where I stored the pet food and cat food. So from my dad's garage in my own car, I will do deliveries here and there. And then that turned into a trucking company. I hired first driver that worked for me. And then from that point on, I kept bringing like independent truckers. I had then the relationship with Nestle, Kellogg's, Unilever, big companies. And it turned into a great trucking company. But then Venezuela started to then get very, very tough. And I decided, this was about 2012, that I wanted to do something different. I want to explore other horizons. So I went to New York, did a program at Columbia University. And then right after, I decided to relocate to the U.S. So in 2014, I decided to relocate to the U.S. and landed in South Florida, right? Port of entry of most Latin American. Not so good to be based in trucking companies in South Florida.
Yeah.
But that's where I started here in the U.S.
So you start, you go to New York, which has been a gateway for so many immigrants to come to the United States. That's Miami. But at New York, what's your impression as a Venezuelan coming to America?
Well, the first big challenge that I had is I come from a very traditional family. Venezuela doesn't have a venture ecosystem. So when you build something in Venezuela, you bootstrap. You don't have big companies or big ventures putting money for you to grow. So it's all about bootstrapping in Venezuela. Or I want to say mostly is bootstrap. And so getting into Colombia in this program and now talking about venture, talking about growth, talking about doing it not in three generations, but you can take your company public. You don't have to wait three generations to get to public. That was a big mindset change that I went through that I definitely love. That's a mosquito that bite me. Into getting into the U.S. and saying, yes, I mean, I want to see my companies grow at that scale. And that's what got me excited to move here and to do it all over again and to get to where I am.
And speaking of scale, I mean, working for Nestle, huge, you mentioned that cocoa production, the chocolate. How does a supply chain like that work now? Because now I'm just curious because it's massive.
Yeah, it's definitely massive. And I think one of the good things that COVID brought to everybody is the attention on supply chain.
Oh, yeah.
Now you're in headlines, right? Before that, it was innovation. It was, I mean, the new product. It was a lot of things, but not supply chain. Now everybody knows that supply chain has to be front and center. I mean, you have seen the consequences of what supply chain.
Getting a ship stuck sideways in that Suez Canal, sure.
Definitely, or not having enough trucks to move and how that affects pricing, how that affects the end consumer.
I ordered a couch last night. You know when it's showing up? This is the delivery estimate. August 30th to September 13th. They're just like, when the F ever? Like, whenever it gets there, it'll be here in the fall. Hopefully it gets here before Christmas. But yeah, you're right. So many consumers are impacted. And one of, I love when that happens just from the perspective of the mainstreamification of freight. It puts people, it puts them in the forefront of their mind because I think once this business touches you, once that mosquito bites you, once you understand distribution, you realize that supply chain should be the focus of every business because it's the lifeblood of the business. It's the inventory that makes it flow. It's the inventory that makes it move. It's the heart that makes it pump.
Yeah, and we had a funny conversation when I worked at Nestle, and there was this sense that nobody gets to get to be the CEO if you come from supply chain.
Yeah.
You have to make your way. If you're in corporate in America or corporate, you have to make your way through marketing or sales or finance. Those are the areas where you really grow, right? But I think that has changed a lot. I think for the good, but also it has changed a lot for the what's been happening in the ecosystem. Why I'm so passionate about what I do is to not only for the fact that supply chain becomes more top of mind, but in becoming more top of mind, the things that we want to do, which is empowering those very small to be able to compete at the same level as the big mega carriers, right, in the area that we are. And to have the possibility where people now think about, that should happen. Why am I... I'm a big corporate manufacturer. Why do I only need to write a check for a dedicated route or a big broker to say my big contracts are with large institutions, can I really give the opportunity for that mom and pop, family owned, owner operator that behaves really well, that really works? Why can't they have that same opportunity and then compete at the same level? And so that's why, I mean, this industry is so great for me. And I think the possibilities are going to be endless.
So 2012, you come in America, is Smart Hop your first business here? What do you do when you get here?
So when I got here, I mean, what I knew how to do was trucking, right? Yeah. And so I said, well, I'm going to do the same, right? I mean, I was based in South Florida. And the first thing that happened was me not having Social Security, no credit cards, no history. The DOT thought that I was a no one because, yeah, you could have a lot of success in Venezuela, but we have no records of you,
yeah.
Right? And so thinking about that, then that's when we mentioned insurance, right? But also thinking about how to buy a truck or a van, how to build your authority, I got the crude reality that I could not. The system wasn't built for me to be able to do something like that. And so I had to start like very small, very local transportation in South Florida, made my way. What I really wanted to do was over the road trucking. So the only way that I could do that was to go under someone's authority. And so going under someone's authority gives you the ability to have your bottom line control, insurance, fuel, lease, they're already pre-negotiated for you. The flip side is you become a franchisee, right? You're under someone. You have their logos on your truck, right? And so in a way, they can say that you're independent, but you end up not being fully independent. And so, but that was my only way for me to be able to get to over the road. So I made my way to over the road. I bootstrapped my company to about 50 trucks on my balance sheet. But I went through the struggles that everybody goes through. At some point, I realized that I didn't want to keep building another asset-based trucking company, but rather bring the technologies and the economies of scale that I didn't have as a small trucker.
Now, let me ask you, before we move past that, why did you make that decision?
Well,
it's pretty crucial, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that decided the direction of where you went now.
I mean, I saw that if you're alone in this massive industry, it's very tough for you to be able to really compete. So I could get to, hopefully, to a couple of hundred trucks and be a mid-size or a small-size carrier, but was I really able to get to the place where I could compete with the mega carriers? I didn't see a clear path. I thought that was going to take sweat and tears. And one of the bad things that happened in this industry is that you can work really hard for the entire year. And that doesn't mean success in trucking. That not necessarily means success in trucking. You can find yourself at the end of the year with no money, with not an ability to pay your dues, and even on the verge of having to close your authority. So that's when I decided and say, for my own sake, but also for the tens of thousands of really hardworking families that are out there. I mean, people spending over the road, they spend weeks at a time. I mean, outside through the continental US without their families, trying to make a living, very stressed, dealing with all this nonsense of manual, trying to book a load. Maybe some people that don't even speak well English, trying to book a load and not having the right tools. And at the same time, having to go on their knees when renewal comes, insurance or others.
License plates,
just to have another year.
Yeah. I mean, we've covered all these carrier bankruptcies. I mean, one of the first ones, the first story I covered when I was here was Falcon Transportation over in Ohio. And that was kind of tethered to the Lordstown GM closure. And it's kind of funny because you mentioned that thing about the C-suite getting jobs. And one of the things that I was told was that at GM, anybody who got the job in supply chain, they immediately wanted to get out. Anybody who's up the upper thing, you had to get to a different department to advance. So there was never any consistency. And that caused a lot of problems for Falcons. But with asset-based companies, you know, $1 million is, it's a nice amount of money when you have it, but it's not a lot of money when you owe it. And in asset-based trucking, these bills can come up at you out of nowhere, and they tend to come up at the worst time, like April of last year when the market tanked and you're getting less than $1 a mile.
No, definitely. And think about if that's happening with the Falcons of the world, if the big carriers are also in the verge of, and they have the possibility to, for a PE to come in and write a check,
yeah.
Not an owner-operator. An owner-operator doesn't have the ability for venture to come and save them. So if you think about that reality, and if you think about those bankruptcies, what's left for the very small owner, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they don't stand the chance. And if, again, your top line, meaning your demand, you have a transactional relationship with brokers, not even with the cargo owners, but you have a transactional business, fluctuations in the spot market can take you out of business in no second. They don't have contracts. They don't have dedicated lanes. They just go on a load per load basis. And so they don't have that relationship to have the stability to be able to even provision or think about a couple of months down the road. That's why they're so fixated with the idea of maximizing every load that they get. And that's why it's so stressful, right? I mean, you need to maximize every load. And so every time that you're on the phone with a broker, you're like trying to fight this huge beast. And the brokers don't, or I want to say they don't understand, but they don't really get that they're not, I mean, truckers are not wanting to negotiate just for the sake of negotiation, just because they like
handle.
To negotiate.
Yeah.
They're watching.
Like you're in a Moroccan bazaar, like just because you want to haggle with people.
No, I mean, that's not why they do this. I mean, they do it because they don't know what's going to happen with them the next week. And so they need to really make sure that they have some provisions. They don't have a contract where they say, yeah, I have a contract with this large institution and I have my year secured. They don't have security for a year. They're only secure.
They got a visitor.
This is part of the show.
Hey, she can stay.
Yeah. So they don't have any security, right? And so that's I think, why I'm so interested and so focused on bringing that security, bringing that, I mean, reducing the stress, helping them. Now we're talking on behalf of 100 trucks, hundreds of truckers with brokers, with insurance companies, with fuel institutions. So now it's not an owner operator trying to get discounts for their fuel. Fuel, it's over 24% of their cost structure. And why are you paying retail rates, right? The big carriers are paying wholesale.
And so, they have the rack rate, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in being able to be the voice of hundreds of truckers that are our customers, that gives us the ability to be able to provide to them what they need to really be successful.
I think she also heard that you're the pet food guy. So she might be thinking you got a delivery for her too. But you bring up a good point because, you know, if you don't follow this industry, you hear something in the news like YRC Yellow getting a gigantic bailout, being treated too big to fail by the U.S. government. Controversially, might I add, I would say a lot of people don't agree with what they got from the government, don't think they deserve it because they weren't that great of a run trucking company before they got that loan. And I think that's pretty fair to say. Most trucking companies are not at liberty to get that kind of stuff. Most have to sort of fend for themselves. And like you said, venture's there. But a lot of venture capitalists, they want to, which you probably recognize too, they look at assets, they look at those balance sheets, and they go, this is really risky. They look at the tech side, though, and they go, hey, asset light, tech side, now we're talking. So you decide to make this diversion, and now you're starting to head in the direction that Smart Hop is going to be there. What starts to form the company?
Yeah, I mean, you touch on a very critical point, and what we want to be able to really try to do is to have our customers become a better business and have a healthier business. They might not have a P&L or a balance sheet, right? And we made this great partnership on the lease side with one of our now investors. And big lease institutions see very small trucking companies. They're not structured to lease an 160K asset to someone that doesn't have a balance sheet, right? And so just because we help them better manage their business, just because we provide the technology and we help them have better relationships on their top line and the bottom line is what's giving our customers the access to a full maintenance lease program. It's what's giving them access to have a controlled bottom line and at the end to be able to remain independent, have their own choice, and be able to utilize our technology in a way where they use it as a support system, but not as something that is telling them what to do. And so what our customers come to us are for three main things. The first is that booking technology. So we developed this autonomous dispatcher that connects through APIs with freight brokers. We analyze in real time the market to be able to tell that person that is in Atlanta what's their best bet, where they should go with which broker, at what price, to help them navigate through that decision-making process of staying on the road for a couple of weeks out. And just last year, we helped our customers overperform their top line in about 9%. So that's huge for them. The second is back office. So you're on the road, you're driving your truck, and yes, there's here and there some administrative tasks that you need to do, right? I mean, you need to report to the brokers. You need to do check calls. Brokers are always trying to find out where you are, if you're going to deliver on time. But then after you execute, then it's invoicing, it's collecting. There's a bunch of different things that aside from that, in like the day-to-day task, we give our customers with that information a way of them understanding a little bit better their business and not having to check at the end of the week their bank accounts to really understand if they did well or not, which I don't want to generalize, but a lot of our customers come from a world where they see their bank accounts to understand how well their business is going. And so having information, having more clarity on what you are doing helps our customers do a better job. And then lastly, the third component is really getting their bottom line to a place where they need to be. And so we want to change the fundamentals of how those products are given to our customers. And think about payments, fuel, lease, and insurance. Why should I be paying for cargo insurance if I'm taking 2 weeks out? I'm not hauling anything. There's nothing on my truck. But still, same old same, right? I mean, I have a yearly premium and I'm a guy with one truck or two. I can't do anything different. And so we really want to change the fundamentals in a way where we are 100% aligned with our customers. When they are on the road, when they earn, we earn with them. We don't take any upfront cost for them. And the beauty about what we do and how we do it is we don't have any contracts. You work with us as long as you want to work. We have seen the most, I want to say, prohibited and bad agreements when it comes to factoring companies and how, I don't want to generalize, but how those contracts don't allow truckers to go elsewhere. Just for the fact that they signed a 30-page agreement that they didn't even know what they were signing.
So you scroll to the bottom of and you click accept just, terms of,
just signed and now you're stuck with them. I mean, I think that needs to change. You need to work with who you want to work until they deliver, not because you signed a contract.
You know, you bring up a lot of interesting points here. One of them is pay, right? And dealing with drivers. And Max Farrell, he's the CEO of WorkHound, their driver sentiment survey company based here in Chattanooga. He was on What the Truck recently, and we were asking him, what's the latest thing in your survey? And, he says, it's the same thing that it's been for a long time now, and it has to do with driver pay, but not necessarily the amount drivers are being paid. It has to do with the consistency of pay. A lot of drivers feel like they don't have a lot of transparency into what they're going to have at the end of the week. Sometimes that can be the driver's fault. they don't know their cost of operating their business. And that happens a lot. You know, you were with Chad Boblett, Rate Per Mile Masters. A lot of complaints there, especially when the spot market bottoms out. Is that kind of a systemic problem in the industry? And do you think that's just the nature of how people get into trucking? They don't tend to have a great financial background, not a lot of financial literacy, so they're figuring it out as they go along?
I want to say that it goes beyond that and it gets to transparency. Yeah. And that's something that this industry really lacks. And I want to say that that's changing and there's players that are there. That's one of the main reasons why I got into this is there needs to be transparency at all levels, right? I mean, and when I got into talking to customers and saying, okay, so why would you give like dispatch into someone else, right? And what's the good and the bad? Why would you consider having a back office and not doing on yourself? Horrible stories. I mean, one guy mentioned the word chop chop. And I'm like, what's chop chop? And he's like, well, if you hire a dispatching service, not transparent, they will get the rate confirmation from the broker. They will Photoshop that. They will take a cut and they will send you the rate confirmation with less money. They get the money, they get a chop, someone else gets the chop, and then I end up with pretty much nothing. And so it goes through transparency, right? I mean, and when you think about the driver, if you think about a company driver, yeah, I mean, if you're working for a company that it's not 100% transparent, you'll get into this place where you don't know what you're going to earn at the end of the week. It happens. It will continue to happen because there's definitely bad apples in this industry, but we need to call that out. When you think about owner-operators, you need to really understand your week. You need to really work with those brokers or those that gives you the load that you trust. For the fact that you can, I mean, it's nonsense. How easy can you get screwed on this industry? And so, it's a real issue, definitely a real issue and something that we want to tackle. And the way that we do it is when we book a load on our booking platform, when we book a load on behalf of someone, our customers through us, it's not Smart Hub booking a load with C.H. Robinson. Yeah. It's our customer booking the load. So using our technology rails to book that load and to run the back office, but it's them. It never sets Smart Hub anywhere. It doesn't flow through us in a way where we can do something about it. And so bringing that transparency also helps the driver really understand what they're getting into.
Why do you, speaking of Rate Per Mile Masters, message boards, why do you think that some truckers have such a negative opinion of dispatch or dispatchers? And can you dispel that? What makes Smart Hub different?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about, I just said what the chop chop mean, but I think it's a trust issue, right? I mean, you have seen the worst of the worst. And in this industry, across the board, there's this sense that I can't trust anyone else, right? I mean, there are bad brokers out there, so I can't trust brokers. They are bad insurance companies, so I can't trust the insurance. So I can't trust anyone. And when I'm loading or unloading, I need to be there because I don't know if they're going to put a claim on me and it wasn't my fault, right? So I think that goes to a trust issue. But the reality is that I think more than like dispatching a truck is how do you get control over your business, right? Truckers more often than not have a husband or a wife or a son dispatching them. So that's giving the ownership of dispatching to someone else. The question is, should I go beyond my family helping me? And the reason why I believe that this is and people are starting to get what we are all about is, we put that support on your hands. So it's not us dispatching you. It's our technology and our support helping you dispatch yourself better, right? And so if you want to be like super hands-on, as we call out-of-book, I mean, we out-of-book you. I mean, you'll get those loads. But if you want to use the technology, if you want to have a saying, then you have the opportunity. It's your business at the end. It's not us controlling you. And so that's, I think, transparency and trust plays a big factor when it comes to dispatching. And the results are there. You're driving. Are you really on the top of your game to be able to book your own loads? And it's not that you don't know how to book your loads. It's not that you have the experience. It's maybe you don't have the time, right? I mean, maybe you're doing something else.
Yeah. She's here again. She wants that dog food out of you.
Yeah.
What's up, girl? Well, so let me ask you something. So my great-grandparents on my dad's side, they are from, silent generation immigrants, right? My grandmother, she's immigrant from Poland. The idea of the American dream, very important with that generation. And kind of stuck with the boomers, but I think as generations move on, it kind of gets lost as people get naturalized. For immigrants like yourself, right, in Venezuela, American dream still a big thing, still a big thing to shoot for, and do you believe in it?
I do believe, and I'm 100% in support of people really having the aspiration of being better. And this is a big country, a lot of opportunities, but you have to be willing to work very hard. Not only in our industry, which, again, I think it's built on resilience, hardworking people, but across the board, the American dream for Venezuela, and I want to extend to Latin America, it's a big thing, right? I mean, when you think about the possibility of being someone, if you really work hard, it's something real. And I have experienced it myself. I mean, I'm living my dream. I was able to come here, even if I didn't have Social Security and I had a tough time going through the system, you always have the opportunity if you do things right. I'm a true believer that if you do things right, you'll have an opportunity. So 100%. I mean, that American dream, not only for me, but for many people, is real.
Yeah, I mean, you come here from Venezuela. You've raised, I think, according to PitchBook, $16 million for Smart Hub. Pretty wild.
Pretty wild.
Pretty wild. How do those pitches go? Because I talked to Jenna Bryan. She's with Embedded Ventures. So we got a little bit into VC. So the audience knows a little bit about how VC works now. How did your pitches go?
I mean, it's I want to say that I came with an incredible component where I came into the tech ecosystem on an industry that I love. So that was, I mean, what else can you ask for, right? And so when you go out and raise money, it's a full-time job. I mean, so you better be prepared and you better have a solid structure. Meantime, you raise money, right? I mean, it's tough. I mean, I came here with no connections, no network. So it's even harder when you don't have that big exit, right? I mean, I don't have that big exit to be able to raise money like super easy. So you have to pitch over and over. I pitch about 120 venture funds on my seed round. A little bit less than that on my Series A.
Sounds exhausting.
But it is. It's like deja vu, right? I mean, you're pitching at the same, I mean, and you're going from one call to the other, pitching the same. But at the end, it also gives you the opportunity to have people that are challenging you. Venture capital, when they receive a call and when you pitch them, their mindset is, how can I quickly say no to this person, right? I mean, that's when they go into a room with you is, let me see if I can find a way of saying no. And that's the way that they can be very efficient to get to the real good companies, right? And so there's a lot of challenges, questions that, I mean, they start to really dig deep into your company. And that also gives you the ability to really understand not only your pitch, but what you are all about. I mean, what's your company all about? Is this real or is this just hype that you can? I mean, there are companies that raise money on paper and that's it. But when it comes to my own experience, I really had the challenge of I don't have an exit. I come from a very traditional world. Trucking, it's not very sexy for Silicon. It's becoming more sexy, but Silicon Valley likes to see software engineers in a room like this and nothing happens outside. But on our industry, I mean, it's where when things start to happen. And so putting people into this notion of this is the real world, but we're impacting real people, real families. It is a great experience. We are fortunate to have incredible venture capital behind us, but also industry insiders. And I always joke that people ask me, and you're a Venezuelan. You came here just a couple of years ago, and you have all these big industry insiders behind you. I'm like, I don't know how I got into their, I want to say small club, but it seems like everybody in this industry comes from or tied to American colors. And so it seems like this is a massive industry, but everybody gets together once a year in Chicago. And then they talk about this industry, but those people or many of them, which now are friends, advisors, and investors, we're very excited to have them just because they believe in our vision.
Yeah. But, you know, you kind of mentioned it there. I think one of the great things about this business, even though it's big, it's still pretty small. You're 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon away from almost anyone as long as you start having some conversations. You know, you can get in touch with nearly anybody you need to. Probably easier than a lot of other industries just because the access can be difficult, but there's just not that many kings and queens. At least not as many as in other industries.
Yeah, that's why I love to go to Chicago because it seems like Chicago is like the epicenter of a lot of the things that happen in this industry.
Yeah, it's big time. So biggest lesson you learned, well, other than the insurance, don't start a trucking company in that part of Florida. What's the failure you've learned the most from, though, since, you know, coming to America and starting a business?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say that one of the biggest lessons that I learned is you need to rely on others and you need to start trusting information. Rely on information as much as you can. When you have a truck that is in Dallas, Texas, and you're deciding where to go, that old saying of, I know from past experience that I should go into this market or the other, but I'm not looking at the real-time data, that can get you into trouble. And so I'm a true believer that as much information as you can get, the better technology that you can use at any level will definitely help you have a better business.
Now, I'm of the opinion that one of the reasons that it's hard to find young drivers is there are no real icons in media, right? Like the last trucking hero was Lincoln Hawk, 1987, Over the Top. 70s, super romanticized. Like you had Convoy, White Line Fever, all of those different movies that really made the on-the-road trucker seemed like this really big thing. Liam Neeson, he's coming out with The Ice Road. It's coming out at the end of June. You think it's going to cause a cultural renaissance where everyone suddenly sees Liam do it and thinks truck is cool again?
100%. I mean, I'm a big fan, and I cannot wait until, I mean, this environment becomes, interesting for people to come back into the industry. I mean, there's something about the good old days where people felt pride of being a truck driver, felt pride about moving goods from one place to another. I think it got lost in the way, but in what's happening and really all the things that the investments that are going into the industry, the cool technology and the cool companies that are coming to life. Liam and making it fun for people as well to feel that pride again. I just hope that that happens.
Yeah. I think you almost like you, because trucking is starting to get more tech oriented. You just mentioned it there. I think you almost have to start marketing towards the geeks out there, the nerds a little bit. Like you want to drive a vehicle with the latest technology, get in the cab, be your own boss, be out on the open road. I mean, I think that's what kind of can make it exciting to people, again, as long as they sort of get over those fears of automation and everything, which, you know, even though you're seeing automated cars go on the roads in Germany, which they just passed legislation, it'll be coming here. I mean, that's still a long ways off. You know, we're not shutting down driving jobs yet. There's still plenty of cabs that need to get seated. Now, you said you were out with Chad Boblett. You're in Kentucky talking about driver shortages. We mentioned the pay and the transparency in pay. What kind of other issues came up that you guys were talking about?
Yeah, so we were talking, generally speaking, on big issues. The thing that it came up the most is how can we come together to really fight that big control system that is not allowing the smallest of the smallest to be able to have a living, generally speaking, right? I mean, I want to be able to be on the road and to the earlier point of really enjoying being on the road, really enjoying this industry is I need to reduce my stress at all levels. I mean, how can I fight and how can we fight and call out those people that are in a way not giving us the opportunity to be better, that they are taking advantage on us. And so the overall theme was, how can we come together and really have a united voice for us to be able to have a way and a channel for us to resolve or overcome the issues that come to us? I think by now, everybody wants to have a life and a family. I mean, I want to go back to my wife and kids and be able to take them out to dinner. I want to, and this is not to put it dramatic, but we have had testimonials of people saying, now I can put back my kids back to school. That's pretty real. And so how can we make that happen? It's not one thing that we need to do. It's like really making sure that the system changes for the good.
Yeah, I mean, it limited our earnings, like you mentioned that thing, but a lot of schools, daycares were closed. I have a 6 and a 4-year-old. I got to work. My wife works too, but she could not do as much freelance work, nearly as much freelance work, because she had to basically become a teacher at home. And that's impacted so many people. You're actually seeing it in the job and labor market too. We were also just talking on What the Truck, how McDonald's is offering people iPhones if you stay on for 6 months. They're closing for hours during the day because they can't fill shifts. But you also mentioned how everyone wants to be home now, especially younger drivers. You know, final miles picking up. You can dedicated routes are picking up, right? There's other ways to not get over the road. Do you think the over-the-road trucker is in danger because it's just so hard to make that job attractive because of the sacrifice you have to make by making that decision to live that way?
It is a definite sacrifice. And I think that there are people that really enjoy being on the road, but over the road, over the years, is going to evolve. And you're going to see more and more shorter shifts. We're hearing more and more people saying, I don't want to be on the road 3 weeks at a time. I might want to do my reset over the weekends back at home. And I'm willing to risk some of my top line earnings just to be back on a weekly basis to my home base. So over the road is going to definitely, it is already shifting, and it's putting pressure for big companies to be able to keep drivers for such of a long time.
Well, Guillermo, it's been a great talk. We're coming in for a landing now, but people who want to reach out to you, they want to work with Smart Hop, where should we send them to?
Yeah, the best way is to go into our site, www.smarthop.co. You can write to hello@smarthop.co or through you, any messages, just contact us. We'll be more than happy to talk to you.
Hey, folks out there, you want to sit in that seat where Guillermo is, email me, tduner@freightwaves.com. Would love to have you in studio, in person. It feels so nice. Good, my man.
Yeah.
Virtual is fine. It's opened the doors. It's made a lot of conversations happen that otherwise couldn't happen. But nothing replaces the real McCoy, a meat sack sitting in the chair right there. So reach out to us. Also, see us November 8th to 10th right here in Chattanooga. Go to live.freightwaves.com. Click on F3. It's the Future of Freight Festival. Over 30 locations. I'll be doing live What the Trucks from there. We'll probably, once I have all you people in town, maybe we'll even have you come over. Maybe you can sit in the seat while you're in town. Like I said, reach out to me. Use promo code WTT. You'll save $200 on the event. That's my gift to you. Find me on Twitter at Timothy Dooner. It's DOONER. Everyone, thank you for stepping inside our world today.